Hi, and welcome to Offensive Shadows,
your weekly visit with Abroad, Her Bud, and the Bard.
I'm Mike.
I'm Danny.
And today we're bringing you part two of Love's Labor's Lost. So last week we covered a little bit of the background of the play, a little bit about the source of the text, and we covered a little bit about the eight major players of the play, the four ladies and the four gentlemen. Just to recap, we have Ferdinand and Barone, who are really the two major players on the men's side, and they have their two sidekicks, who really don't do too much.
Dumaine and Longueville, who are, for the most part, interchangeable.
And on the lady side, we have Rosalind and the princess, and then it's Catherine and
Mariah, yeah. And it's funny because the lovers are so interchangeable that in most productions that you'll see, they make their costumes color-coded so that you can tell who belongs with whom.
Yeah, that's probably pretty wise because Ferdinand and Barone, you can tell apart pretty easily. The princess and Rosaline, pretty distinct. The other four are really interchangeable parts. They're just really sidekick type characters.
I mean, Kenneth Branagh solved this problem with a creative use of race-blind casting, wherein he had one of the male lovers, I think it was Dumaine, was a beautiful black man. Oh, he is gorgeous and he can dance. And then one of the lady lovers was a beautiful black lady, but they didn't wind up together, which I thought was pretty awesome.
That's kind of cool. So as we promised last week, we're also going to touch on some of the common characters of the play, which are contrasted in the first two acts with the nobles. So we start off with the nobles, and specifically the men, denying their manliness and denying love and going into seclusion.
I wouldn't say it's denying their manliness. They just decide that they're just not going to participate in life for a while, you know? And when you make an inflexible law that is so rigid in Shakespeare, it has to be challenged. It just has to be. I mean, Measure for Measure comes out of this later. You can't make inflexible, rigid laws in Shakespeare. It doesn't work.
Yeah, and they're challenged on that particular oath within, you know,
like 30 seconds.
Seconds of making it, yes. In contrasting that, we have Don Armando. We have Jacquinetta. Now, Don Armando actually is a noble. He's just a Spaniard. He's kind of like a knight errant.
Yeah, he's a special boy. Remember how I said that Navarre eventually became part of the Spanish Empire because it's in the Pyrenees? He is probably, like, from a very nearby neighboring place. He is a don, so he does have rank, but it's quite obvious that English is his second language, so he has some issues communicating with the rest of the players.
Yeah, this is unfortunately one of the problems with the play when communicating with a modern audience. He is supposed to be a very funny character, and I think a lot of his jokes or a lot of the humor around the character falls flat because it just doesn't translate well nowadays to a modern audience. He's still, if you have a good actor in the role, as we had with the Glow production that we saw, he's still a funny character, but he's not as funny as I think he probably was.
Oh, without a doubt. And even when you do have a good actor, he has some long scenes that are just insufferable. That's one of my critiques of the Glow production. Those scenes really needed a trim.
Yeah, the Glow production, like we said before, was a good production. And the Globe has a tradition of not really trimming too much, and they probably should have trimmed a lot on this play. Because we'll see later on, late in the play, there is a scene that most of the humor comes around from having knowledge of the Latin language, and it just falls dead for a modern audience.
Yeah, I don't even think that there would be an equivalent. Like, I don't even think it's the sort of humor you could... I hate the word translate when you talk about Shakespeare, but in this case, it almost literally is translating. Eubonics, maybe? I don't even know.
Yeah, that's the only thing that would even come close, but we'll save that for later.
So with Don Armado, there's his servant, Mote. It is spelled Moth, M-O-T-H, but it is pronounced Mote. And this is a joke on his size. He is a teeny tiny little lad, and in most modern productions you will find the smallest woman you can possibly find and dress her up like a boy. And he basically pals around with Don Armato. And
yeah, he's kind of his sidekick. He's kind of actually more like his...
He's like a babysitter, really. Like,
well, yeah, he's kind of like a babysitter, but he's kind of his foil. Don Armato plays off him a little bit. Opposing Don Armato in his quest for love is Costard.
Costard!
So Costard is kind of the first of Shakespeare's fools that we get who kind of stands up to the nobility. He's not really a servant of anyone. Kind of like in Taming of the Shrew, we have Grumio, Petruchio's servant, who's one of the fools, although some might argue that Petruchio could be a fool himself.
Well, what you're talking about with Costard, it's the first of the wits, and I'm putting air quotes around wits. We broadly classify Shakespeare's fools, and by we I mean actors, not so much the scholars, but the actors, broadly classify Shakespeare's fools into a couple different categories. You have the wits, like Costard and Touchstone, which are the ones that use words and language to be funny.
Yeah, he's not really a physical comedy character. I mean, there are certain scenes where you can, and the Globe production that we saw had some physical comedy in there, but he's definitely a wordy comedian.
Well, the thing about the wits and performing as a wit is that you need to have a certain amount of physical comedy to make the jokes land. Because, like we are struggling with this entire show, language is not a medium that the American public is used to having, really.
It's this language, yes. This form of language. So you really need the exaggerated body language of physical comedy to help convey what's being said.
But at the same time, you can't lean too heavily on it, or you'll be betraying the text and betraying the soul of the character.
Yep. And I think the Globe production did a really good job of that, with this character.
The other thing with Costard, he has one of the prime examples that so-called First Folio Method teachers use to say that their method works. So there's a school of reading Shakespeare's text and actor training. It started with John Barton at the RSC and has been continued on in the United States by John Basil, my teacher. And basically they say that the First Folio is Shakespeare's pure text, and that every single word, every single letter, every single punctuation mark is a clue to the actors, because Shakespeare was a master of language, and if he didn't mean for them to be there, then they wouldn't be there. Now, historiographically, there are some serious issues with this argument, including early modern printing practices, the fact that most of the plays weren't actually printed off of Shakespeare's papers, and the fact that they were typeset by people who didn't really know what they were doing. So a lot of times these spelling deficiencies and things can be explained away by those factors. However, it's a method that I have seen works very well for actors. And Costard, in the first scene that he's in, he comes in and Don Armato has written a letter to Ferdinand and describing this horrible person he ran into. And Costard keeps interrupting Ferdinand, saying, "Me?" And he says it three different ways. There, it's like M-E-E, M-E, and then he says, "Oh, me." So First Folio Method people are like, "Here, look at Costard. This is why my method is true." And they're not wrong, but they're not right.
Yeah, it sounds like that you really can't attribute it necessarily to Shakespeare's brilliance, but it is a good method of looking at the text and extracting acting cues and information on how to play the character.
I mean, all acting really is taking a bunch of tools that a bunch of teachers over time have put into the universe and figuring out what works best for you. And especially when you're acting Shakespeare, you need a way to unlock this text that is going to read to a modern audience. I have seen this method work very, very well, despite the fact that I have some huge problems with it as a historian. There's also Constable Dull in this show, debatably one of the best character names in all of history.
Who gets to say, "I am Dull"?
Or, "I am Dull."
So, and he is definitely, his name describes his character, as so often is the case in Shakespeare.
Especially this play that's so obsessed with language.
And where Constable Dull is kind of the straight man to Costard, for at least for the first half of the play. Costard steps into the play, getting himself into a fair amount of trouble with the constable.
Yeah.
In his pursuits of Jacquinetta.
Yeah, and in any production worth its salt, and certainly in the Globe production, whenever Jack Winetta and Costard are on stage, they will be physically assaulting each other to the point of, like, crimes of public indecency. But I'm not convinced they have it wrong. Because, I mean, we know warring against your own affections is always dangerous in Shakespeare. You just can't do it.
Well, what's interesting is Jack Winetta has two men chasing after her at the start of the play. Both Don Armato and Costard. She doesn't necessarily seem to be all that interested in the beginning in either one of them.
Don Armato just does such a horrible job of wooing Jack Winetta that it's no wonder that she doesn't see him at all. He doesn't quite get it. He tries very hard. It's very cute, but he doesn't quite get it.
So all through the first two acts, we have a little bit of back and forth between Don Armato and Costard and Jack Winetta. That contrasts the lords and the ladies, where we have the common folk chasing after the eye of their affection, and we have the noble folk trying to put on airs and rejecting things. And Barone's kind of the first one who comes out and says, "This is stupid.
Well, he said that in the first scene.
Yes.
But so it's.
But no. When the ladies show up, he's also the first to say, "I really don't want to do this."
It is small wonder that Barone folds first, because he was the first one in the first scene to be like, "This is dumb. Dumb. D-U-M. Dumb. Dumb. Da-dum-dum." Dumb.
So, and Barone is the first to break. Early in Act 3... he is breaking the oath and sending little love notes to Rosaline.
Which will get wrapped up really nicely in Act 4, by the way. He gets his.
So, and then after the delivery,
after he hands off the letter.
Yeah, after he hands off the letter, the delivery takes forever to actually occur. We have his love sucks speech.
It's very cute. Have a listen.
"And I, forsooth, in love? I, that have been love's whip, a very beadle to a humorous sigh, a critic, nay, a night watch constable, a domineering pedant over the boy, than whom no mortal so magnificent. This wimpled, whining, pure-blind, wayward boy, this senior junior, this giant dwarf. Don Cupid, regent of love rhymes, lord of folded arms, the anointed sovereign of sighs and groans, liege of all loiterers and malcontents, dread prince of plackets, king of codpieces, sole imperator and great general of trotting parators. Oh, my little heart! And I to be his corporal of his field, and wear his colors like a tumbler's hoop. What I love, I sue? I seek a wife, a woman that is like a German clock, still a repairing, ever out of frame, and never going aright being a watch, but being watched that it may still go right. Nay, to be perjured, which is worst of all, and among three, to love the worst of all, a whitely wanton with a velvet brow, with two pitch balls stuck in her face for eyes, aye, and by heaven, one that will do the deed though Argus were her eunuch and her guard. And I to sigh for her, to watch for her, to pray for her. Go to! It is a plague that Cupid will impose for my neglect of his almighty, dreadful, little might. Well, I will love, write, sigh, pray, sue, and groan. Some men mislove my lady, and some... Joan?"
Oh, Barone. Oh, he's so cute. I love him. He's the wittiest of the lovers, but, I mean, his passion is only different from the others because of how rueful it is. But that makes sense, because Rosaline is the thorniest of the women.
I was going to say, his passion is different from the others because he picked the most dangerous of the four women.
It's true. She does have a bite.
And she really does not actually ever give in to him throughout the entire play.
No, even her speech at the end, which we have for you in a later episode, is... very prickly.
Yeah. I don't want to get too much into the end, but this play does not necessarily have a happy romantic ending at the end.
We'll get there. The interesting thing about Rosalind is that her beauty is described as dark. Now, we have to take into consideration that that probably meant she was a brunette instead of a blonde. Like Julia is described that way. I think Hermia is described that way.
So we're not talking about Othello dark here.
No, we're not talking about Othello dark. We're talking about a brunette. But it also might be linked to the Dark Lady of the Sonnets, which is the most famous sort of dark lady in Shakespeare. Remember how I was talking about that guy, the Earl of Southampton, that got caught up in that unfortunate Essex thing? And how
you mean the unfortunate attempted coup?
Yep. And how this play might possibly have been written for a private performance at his house. Well, Shakespeare dedicates the sonnet cycle to Southampton.
All the sonnets?
Yeah, all of them. They come in like a bunk. Sonnet 127 specifically, and I'll link it in the show notes. I don't want to give you like a reading right now, but it talks about black and dark beauty and in a way that a lot of scholars think sort of echoes Barone. And it's pretty feasible that if Shakespeare was writing this show, Love's Labour's Lost, for performance at Southampton's house, but also talking about the Dark Lady and the sonnet cycle, it might be linked together. Now you know about the love triangle and the sonnet cycle, right?
Well, you have the narrator of the sonnet, or the was it the poetic eye?
Yes, the poetic
as
eye.
As in the poetic me, not the poetic eyeball.
Correct. So that's not to be confused with the biographical eye, which is Shakespeare, but the poetic eye and the young boy who he talks about in the first bunch, clump of the sonnets. And then there comes in this dark lady right around sonnet 127. He starts talking about a dark lady. And then the young boy and the dark lady get together and the poetic eye, not Shakespeare. Shakespeare's all like, oh my God, they're together, but is this so bad? But oh my God, why is this happening to me? So him putting a dark lady in this play might have sort of been connected there.
Something Southampton favored?
Something or other, you know.
Are you trying to say Southampton had a thing for brunettes?
Southampton had a thing for brunettes, apparently, yes.
Is that a historical fact, or are we just speculating here?
Wild speculation. Not so wild speculation, actually. The play is also obsessed with fame and Navarre's image of cormorant devouring time, which can be linked to the devouring time of the sonnets. Just sort of more clues that Shakespeare had these things kicking around in his head at the same time.
Yeah, he was basically riffing on the same theme.
Yeah.
Do we know when the sonnets were written?
The sonnets are first published in a 1609 quarto, but some of them, sonnets 138 and 144 specifically, have been published in a 1599 volume, including The Passionate Pilgrim. And it's very likely that these poems were sort of circulating before they were published.
So they could have been written around the same time.
They could have, maybe. You know, it's so hard to...
It's hard to tell.
Yeah. I mean, sonnets, they're little pieces of poetry. Like, you write them on scraps of paper, you know, and if you're Shakespeare, you probably write them, you know, in the back of your head all the time, so who
probably
knows?
Probably has a wastebasket full of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it for this week. Next week, we're going to delve a little bit into the middle acts of the play and the point where the four boys finally catch each other attempting to sneak notes and breaking their oath. We have the great breakdown of the men deciding to attempt to finally court the women. And of course, they screw that up horribly.
And my favorite speech in the canon.
It is a good speech. And we'll also touch on some late entries to the play. There are a ton of characters in this play, and we have two scholars who show up near the end who have probably one of the worst scenes in Shakespeare.
Hey.
At least the one scene that does not read well at all. The one scene in this play that will put you to sleep.
Anyway.
Thanks for listening.
Offensive Shadows would like to thank Mr. Christopher Knowles for the wonderful logo art, Mr. Matthew Rose Valley for the beautiful music, and Mr. Angelo Calderon for his vocal styling.
Although I do like to ask you one question per podcast that you aren't prepped for. And this is the point in the podcast where we Google